fall. Baby, it's a lie. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Well, March the 11th, 2011, was when the Fukushima, you could say reactors, three out of the four that were up and running, went down and went into meltdown. The great tsunami hit the coast, the east coast of Japan, earlier that day, and knocked out these nuclear reactors along the coast there. Well, we're going to feature that and also in this program tonight, but we're also going to cover some other things about China. Greg Reese has a real good introduction here that he did for InfoWars. We're going to start off with that, and then we're going to do some China clips. Pillsbury was over about a year ago at the Oxford Union. He had some important things to say about China. And then we're just going to pick up and make some comments and end with the Fukushima. But we also have our second hour. We have an interview that we did with Helen Caldicott, and she is really anti-nuclear power all the way. And that's where I have to come down now, because it's very dangerous and just can't remove the danger of spent radiation that easily. So here we go with Greg Reese, and he gives us an overall thing about this reset and all this master plan that's going on. It's coming out of Europe and America, and the global elites are pushing this. So here we go with Greg Reese.
If you want to know the enemy, read their agenda in their own documents. In their weekly strategic intelligence newsletter, the World Economic Forum spotlighted the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which they define as a fundamental change in the ways we live and work, merging the physical, digital, and biological worlds, and fusing technologies in ways that create both promise and peril. They link to a library of articles on the subject and give us the trending top five. Requiring vaccine passports for certain activities, discrimination, or behavioral change. Except when the subject of discrimination comes up, it has nothing to do with a person's rights not to be vaccinated. The so-called discrimination has to do with lower-income countries not getting the jab until 2022. The doublespeak is that not getting a vaccine for an imaginary virus is discrimination. The author Joan Costa Ifant, an associate professor of political science at the London School of Economics, writes that taking a vaccine is pro-social behavior and described those who would refuse a vaccine as vaccine resistant. Costa Ifant went on to describe these people as contrarians, stating that their very existence might be healthy for the rest of us, and that vaccine passports would change their behavior by forcing them to get vaccinated if they wanted to travel. Costa Ifant wrote that those who comply do so to virtue signal, and that this should be used as a way to push the vaccine passport. And if anyone thinks he is concerned about a dangerous pandemic, he also wrote that the use of passports should be limited to non-essential services. The next article, written by senior executive at Mitsubishi Chemical Corporation, warns that the world has only 10 years to change course before ultimate climate disaster. And the only way to save the world is to give government leaders oversight of policy, regulation, and research and development of all the world's industry. Sounds like old school communism, but they are now calling it circularity. In The Efficacy of COVID-19 Vaccines is Linked to Good Nutrition, the author admits that a healthy diet and nutrition will strengthen the immune system and protect a person from infection. But the efficacy to be concerned about is how malnutrition can affect the quality of immune response to vaccination. And what is of utmost importance is providing information on COVID-19 vaccines. A boring article on carbon revenue and the redistribution of wealth. And finally, how happiness, anger, and anxiety can help you negotiate, which speaks to their mentally ill communist cult selling the anti-human agenda on how it would be wise to reserve happiness and how anger can lead to gains by soliciting concessions from the counterpart. However, the anger must be deeply felt. The World Economic Forum is indeed a weird cult of big bank multinational corporation weirdos. But this is reality. Without any sort of resistance, this global communist model is what's coming to your new normal. For InfoWars.com, this is Greg Reese.
Well, folks, we're in the throes of 1984, Brave New World and all that right now. And what we've got to do is we've got to try to educate people into this world communist movement that is actually been perpetuated by the global elites. And so the wealthiest people that dominate the biggest, most wealthy corporations in the world are trying to bring about world communism, but for the lower classes. You could say there's a corporate fascist type of capstone that below that is administering and trying to transform not only America right now, but the whole world into a world communist state. So that's what we're up against now. Now, Michael Pillsbury, a year ago, about March of 2020, was at the Oxford Union talking about this Cold War and how China has manipulated us over the years. And here's what he had to say about this manipulation by China. And he's really, really insightful and just right on top of this China problem.
With that, I now look to Dr. Michael Pillsbury to close the case for the proposition.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I hope you don't change your mind after 10 minutes. I agree with Mike here, the other Mike, that this is a debate about semantics. And the reason you should vote for us and walk through the right-hand door over there is that we have the better case about China. The issue that I want to compliment the lady here, I don't know your name, I'm sorry, but the question about, you know, what's this come down to, this Cold War versus getting a little bit tougher on China. What President Trump's been doing began with President Obama, and actually you were there. President Obama decided in a number of areas, almost using the same words that President Trump did a couple of days ago, enough from China. So he indicted 5 Chinese military hackers and put their photos up online and talked about the unit that they were doing. They were hacking into our nuclear reactor company in Pittsburgh to get a better market advantage to sell probably 100 nuclear reactors over the next few years. He drew a line in some sense in the South China Sea and began, after a break for a few years, he began having our Navy conduct freedom of navigation operations, but in a tactful way that President Trump has continued. These ships do not go in and circle and go at night, turn on their weapons radar, or launch helicopters. If you do any of those five things inside Chinese waters, they could consider it an act of war. So President Obama didn't do it. President Trump doesn't do it. In the trade issue, President Obama pioneered the way, but beginning to raise a lot of issues in the so-called TPP agreement that would focus on environment, labor, many other things. What President Trump took from that was that more pressure was needed. So when I hear you use the word semantics, which is correct, and for you to raise the issue, what really is at stake here between the two teams? To me, new Cold War is a trick. It's a Chinese term. Whenever we or other countries, too, try to bring pressure on China of any kind, this is what they say. You are screwing around with Cold War mentality. Cold War mentality to the Chinese is anybody who puts pressure on them. It's that simple. Both Anastasia and Anna said, I think correctly, China thinks the Cold War by the West began a long time ago. There are different years. One military film I love called Silent Contest in 2013 said the West is even using rock and roll music to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party. Other authors, in my book, I try to take this back. When did this demonization of the West begin? You know who they say was the first real Cold Warrior against China? Abraham Lincoln. So they would laugh at us having a debate here whether we should start a new Cold War. Hey, it's 150 years of containment by you Westerners. Now, what's really at issue is the degree of pressure to ratchet up on China. We know business as usual doesn't work. If you want to endorse business as usual, walk out the left side. If you want more pressure on China to get results, you've got to walk out our side. Let me give you some examples. All kinds of comments about tariffs will never work. The Chinese were laughing, saying, yes, yes, tariffs will never work. They wouldn't come to the negotiating table. The first tariffs were put on. They showed up. Not much progress. They reneged on roughly half the agreement. Pressure went up another notch. A lot more tariffs. Guess what happened? A beautiful, what President Trump calls beautiful, trade agreement suddenly emerged from China, in which they promised no more intellectual theft, property theft, no more technology coercion, long list. The thing is 96 pages long. The Chinese version is pretty accurate, actually. What caused that? Pressure. So to me, and by the way, I'm a Cold Warrior. You can get a medal for being in the Cold War. I actually got it. I was head of policy planning in the Pentagon in the middle of the Cold War under President Reagan. And yes, there were some scary moments. And the Kennedy people would tell us even earlier in 62, you think it's scary now under Reagan, look what happened. We almost had basically nuclear winter and the elimination of all life on Earth, except Herman Kahn said a few men and women will be underground and they will populate the Earth again, in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. So the Cold War was scary, it was dangerous, it was 50 years, it's not a good model for what to do with China for the next 50 years. But to vote against us means you want business as usual. And what that really means is Chinese, what shall we say? They like the word ba. Chinese domination of technology innovation, human rights issues, global governance, the redefinition of the values of the West, religious oppression, a rather long list that I think both sides agree on Chinese misconduct. The issue is what to do about it. So, new Cold War that leads to the extermination of all life on Earth. Anybody for that? I don't think so. But new Cold War with a little bit more pressure. Why is that important? And Anna mentioned this. Chinese Communist Party next year celebrates its 100th anniversary. I don't plan to go. Maybe some of you do. if you're a Communist Party member in China, there's 92 million of them, by the way, you've got to learn the history of the party. The history of the Communist Party of China is a struggle between reformers and hardliners. They often kill each other at the very top. President of China kills Vice President of China. House arrest for the Communist Party leader at the time of Tiananmen. House arrest for the rest of his life. Wouldn't it be interesting to know what these debates are about? The West is involved in them, sometimes directly. What to do about the West is what they fight about. So without using the word New Cold War, which is very provocative, it's insulting. It, by the way, in the old bad Soviet-American Cold War, no American leader ever said to a Russian, "We're in a Cold War with you." We had detente, we had summits, we had arms control agreements, we had some limited trade, but it wasn't the end of the world to have strategic tension and rivalry. So what President Trump's been trying to do, he's increased the amount of military exchange programs between us and the Chinese. Is that a bad thing? Is that a new Cold War? The Chinese say it is. They see these American officers are going to interact with our officers and turn them against the Communist Party. Our embassy in Beijing, largest staff in the world, 2,300 people, officials working on China. 50 U.S. government agencies are in China now, each one helping some counterpart in China. Is this a new Cold War? The Chinese say yes. These programs are designed to subvert us. So to me, new Cold War means we increase these programs. President Trump has a phone call once a month, at least, with his friend Xi Jinping, up to an hour. There was this kind of dialogue also in the Cold War. Reagan wrote letters to Brezhnev, and you know what happened? He answered them. So the end of the old bad Cold War was what? The reformers in Russia took control. Gorbachev, and then even better, Yeltsin, won and changed that whole system. They even put the Soviet Communist Party on trial in Moscow. For China, our help from the outside, without calling it a new Cold War, will help the reformers in China win. And that's the kind of China we want. President Trump wrote about this in a book several years ago, and I'll close with this. He called it, there's a good China and a bad China. And we want the good China.
Next up is Kyle Bass. He has quite an insight into the Far East, or into China, into the Pacific. But he also says that this social unrest is, he says that this inequality of income and wealth is continuing, it's not getting any better. And he sees that this may perpetuate more and more social unrest, but also coupled with the quantitative easing that the Fed is continuing to do spells doom, really, from what I can tell, to our economy and to our financial well-being. And when does it end? Who knows? But here's what Kyle Bass had to say in a recent interview.
I guess, Kyle, we've made a point in the past. It's got to be great to just be able to stimulate forever. You know, throw a trillion here, a trillion there, 1.9 trillion here, 3 trillion there, and just. And it would be great because it does help GDP. We're always worried about, you know, the chickens coming home to roost. If we can sell our bonds and they're that attractive, do we delay the eventual arrival of the chickens coming home to roost so you can, you know, we can party like it's 1999 with the stimulus because we don't have to worry about rates going up? I think that's his point why it's tough to be bearish on stocks here.
That's right. I mean, look, I had breakfast with Kuroda a few years ago, and I said, you know, you guys own more than 100% of GDP of your bonds at the BOJ, and yet you say you're not monetizing your deficit. And he gave me a big belly laugh and he said, Kyle, we're only monetizing our deficit when the market tells us we're monetizing our deficit. And in the end, we're 10, 15 years behind Japan and their QE program. And so is Europe. And so we're all in this together. And the Fed, these central banks are never going to turn and decide to be fiscally conservative again. I mean, Joe, when was the last time you heard the words Tea Party? You know, even under a Republican administration, we just forgot that we needed to be fiscally conservative. So now we have, I think we're going to have ever increasing deficits. And what politicians have learned is deficits don't matter. The Fed's going to be there for them. And the Fed has been engaging in extraordinary monetary policy for the last decade. So it's not going to change anytime soon. It's only going to get worse.
Well, anytime soon. Do I need to feel like I'm in the roaring 20s and we're closing in on 1929? I mean, when do you see, I mean, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, what you're describing. And we become less and less concerned as we go along. Do you expect the eventual comeuppance to be much worse based on that? Or is there a way to spread it out so that we work it off over time with growth? It's hard to grow when you have that much debt, though.
You know, the last time the U.S. was at this debt level as a percentage of GDP was after we deficit spent going into World War II. But in 1946, we had about 106% of GDP. But guess what? We won the war, and we reduced the productive capacity of two continents. And we ran a trade surplus with every single trading partner that we had on the back end of World War II. And we were able to pay that debt down over, call it the next 30 years, into a very low level. I actually don't think that's the case this time. Clearly, we're not engaged in a world war, and we're not running a trade surplus with almost anyone in the world. So, you know, I actually think what the quote comeuppance here is going to be is further stretching of our call it social fabric in our country, right? That the rich are going to get much richer, again, in a nonlinear way. The middle class won't be able to reach up to the next house price because their incomes aren't moving as fast as asset prices. And the poor are just going to stay poor. So that gap, that wealth gap is going to continue to widen. And that with it is going to come more social unrest. The fact that President Biden's here now, everyone might be taking a breath and saying we're going to be back to unity. But this is a much deeper problem. The Fed can't have its cake and eat it too.
Right.
And I think social discord is what's going to, our discourse is going to happen.
So nobody seems concerned. Jamie Dimon, chief executive officer of J.P. Morgan Chase. I've got just a clip here, about 15 minutes of his interview, and he doesn't seem to be that concerned, but boy, J.P. Morgan Chase is big in China, and that's why they all came together to get rid of Trump, because they wanted to get back in bed with China. I know Lenin, who founded the Communist Party in the USSR, in Russia, if you could say pre-USSR, said one time of the West, he said, the West is going to sell us the rope we hang them with. And I'm afraid that's where we're headed now, is China is buying up this country and is buying them lock, stock, and barrel. And I want you to listen to Jamie Dimon talk about their operations and their banking. And I checked out J.P. Morgan Chase in China, and they are just in there, you know, shoulder to shoulder with all those other bankers and interests. So, you know, they got rid of Trump so they could do what they wanted to in the payoffs that they're receiving, whoever they might be. And there's a lot of people. And Swalwell was appointed back to the Intelligence Committee, and that's, you know, in the House. Now, what is that all about? This is getting crazy now. But listen to Jamie Dimon, what he says so nonchalantly about their operations.
It's been almost a year since you suffered a pretty major health scare. So I just want to begin by asking, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great, actually. I'm exercising again. I've got most of my health back and been coming to the office since June, pretty much. So happy to be back at work.
Let's talk about competition. You recently told your bankers they should be scared, expletive, about the threat posed by financial technology companies and others coming into the industry. Isn't that a bit defeatist?
A little bit, but I didn't mean it quite that way. So many years ago, we sent an airplane full of people to China to go to the competition. So J.P. Morgan itself is doing great. So all of our people, look at it, we're doing quite fine. But you have fintech, big tech. You saw Walmart recently. So we just have to be prepared for intensified competition. We're ready for it. We're very competitive, and we expect to win.
But prepared how? What does that mean? Do you have to go out and buy something? Can you build it organically? Do you invert the Walmart model and just start opening delicatessens to compete toe-to-toe?
No, so we already have 5,000 branches. We're going to open another 400 in the next couple of years. We'll be in all 48 states. And, of course, those branches do a lot. They take deposits. They do wealth management. They do small business lending. They are really important to private banks, commercial banking clients, et cetera. So, no, we've got the people, the capability. We can do 100% organic. However, we're open-minded. If people have ideas for us about acquisitions or partnership, we're completely open to have those conversations too.
But the growth of some of these fintech companies, you know, if I look at Adyen or Stripe, for example, it's been so exponential. And then I look at what some of your competitors have done, Morgan Stanley, notably with the E-Trade deal. Do you not think there would be a case we made that JP Morgan should go out and just buy one of these giant fintech companies, plug it in, and then you're good to go?
Yeah. So you should assume we look at everything. And like I said, some of the things we do ourselves, we've done quite well in these areas too. But you're absolutely correct. Some of these people have done a great job. And sometimes it's not cheaper. It's not even better. It's usually just ease of use or something like that. But I assume they're coming. I've dealt with competition my whole life, and we're open-minded to acquisitions. We're open-minded to building ourselves. But what we tell the people here in this very room, in fact, is we should do what we need to do to win in technology, people, systems, marketing, analytics, AI. And obviously, we're doing an awful lot of AI and cloud work and things like that.
Another thing fintech has done, or at least is partly responsible for, is this sort of democratization of investing. Obviously, the rise of the retail trader, the Reddit crowd, Roaring Kitty, whatever you want to call it, is creating this narrative at the moment of David v. Goliath. Now, as a very prominent Goliath, do the Davids have a point? Is the system rigged?
God.
Stacked against them, at least.
For in every bull market, this has happened in my life. So this is not a new phenomenon. And I do believe that people should learn how to invest their money, but they should do the homework. I mean, thinking you go on and just gamble and play, that doesn't have a long-term success record. And so, but to the extent that people are learning and they're getting involved, so that's a good thing. So for some, it's going to end badly, and for some, it'll probably end up well. But the best investors learn over a long period of time how to be a good investor. Just like the best tennis players, the best boxers, the best media folks, the notion that you can be great at it because you... I remember my daughter made her first investment and it went up, and I was thinking to myself, oh God, it would have been far better had it gone down. You learn a little bit more that way sometimes.
Well, one bit of the industry that obviously has been savaged to some extent recently is the short selling hedge funds. Do you think that industry is in crisis because of this effect we're seeing, or this phenomenon of the retail trader?
Absolutely not. The retail trading in dollars is a teeny, what you're talking about is a teeny weeny little bit of the market. The market is global. I mean, something like $10 trillion is bought and sold every single day. And when we say investors, you're talking about retail investors, pension plans, hedge funds, money managers, individuals. I've been buying and selling stocks since I've been 12 or 13. So I believe in that. But my dad taught me how to read a balance sheet when I was 13. It wasn't just, you know, maybe I was guessing a little bit, but it opens it up. But no, there are legitimate complaints about short selling, more around transparency and the duplication of the vote of the ability to short sell the stock. There are legitimate issues around all these things. That, you know, if the regulator is going to be looking at payment for order flow, high frequency trading, disclosure about ownership, voting, short selling, those are good things. And, you know, to me,
should people be able to pay for order flow?
I think payment for order flow is a very complex subject. I think there should be but there should be much stricter rules about what you mean by that. It's not clear to me that everyone does the same payment for order flow. So if I'm paying a lot more to someone else or keeping a lot more for myself, you probably have the right to know. And there are certain disclosures that are not very good.
Moving on to the biggest question in finance right now, which is the stimulus enough? Is it too much? Even the interventionists can't seem to agree on this point. You have Larry Summers on the one side saying enough already. You have Janet Yellen, Jay Powell, and others on the other saying more is needed. What do you think?
So getting through COVID is absolutely critical. And we're still in it, though God knows it looks like there's light at the end of the tunnel, you know, by the beginning of the summer or something like that. And it's not a binary subject. I think, you know, Democrats and Republicans are like ships passing the night. There are legitimate complaints about stuff in this bill that has nothing to do with COVID. there are a lot of people suffering who need help. Both are true. So if you want to go through, you go through all the detail. Unemployed, they definitely need help. Small businesses, they definitely need help. People at the lower end, they definitely need help. Women who had to go home, who basically stopped working because they had to go take care of something like that, they definitely need help. You know, does every, I don't know if you know this, but like half the states, revenues went up. They didn't go down. Do they need help? You know, and we just throwing money at people at one point. So, and there will be another side to that mountain. So they should be cautious about overdoing it. Get us through the problem, get the country growing. But, you know, don't try not to overdo it too much.
But isn't the risk exactly that? That if you have places and states, people that don't need help and are getting the help, you overflood the system. Yeah. You do create this huge risk of inflation.
Yeah, and the system already has a little bit of that. So if you look at what's in the system, it looks to us like there's $1 trillion, $1 trillion of this unspent. That's before this $1.9 trillion. So there will be money. Like, you know, there's a very good chance you're going to have a gangbuster economy for the rest of this year and, you know, easily into 2022. And the question is, does that overheat everything? And we just don't know yet. But I would put that on the things to worry about. You know, I wouldn't worry too much about it. I would worry more about COVID and nuclear war than I'd worry about that. But you know, I would suspect there's a pretty good chance you're going to see rates going up and, you know, people starting to worry about that at one point.
Let's talk about COVID for a second.
I've been very clear. I would not buy 10-year treasuries, just so you know.
On COVID, we are obviously doing this interview in person, which is fantastic. We're doing it in your offices here in New York, but still largely empty, as are my offices, as probably are a lot of people's offices. How important is it to a business like JP Morgan to actually have people physically coming back to work?
It's very important. I mean, I do think there'll be part of the world where a certain amount of people work from home permanently, certain sales, certain ops, so you can track the productivity, et cetera. I think there'll be a large portion who permanently work in the office. Think of our branches, cash management, probably most of the trading floors, et cetera. And there'll be some hybrids where you spend 2 weeks at home and 2 weeks in the office or 3 weeks at home, a week in the office, or 3 days and 2 days and 2 days, 3 days. But so I think it will reduce the need for commercial real estate. But there are huge weaknesses to the Zoom world. I mean, most of us learned by an apprenticeship system, by, you know, seeing mistakes, going to trips, how to handle a client, how to handle a problem. So it's hard to inculcate culture and character and all those things when you have the Zoom world. Spontaneous combustion, it goes away. Hard to manage. You know, it's hard to be very critical. You got 15 people on the screen. So what before was like a deep dive question now looks a little bit rude. And I took a trip to California and met 100 people all outside, all wonderful, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's amazing how much you learn about your own business, your own bankers, your own clients, your own products. And, you know, I met with Snowflake and Marketa. What you learn about technology and systems, you're not going to do that in the Zoom world. And, you know, so bankers, you know, relationships. I think it's very hard to build and develop and deepen a relationship on the Zoom world. So you still, you know, there'll be more Zooming. People like me will travel just as much as I did in the past.
As and when the vaccine does become available for your workforce, will you make it mandatory for people to take it if they do want to return?
It's hard to make it mandatory. And there are laws about that. But I think what we'd like to do is kind of have carrots and sticks. We want people to take it. I think it's a far better thing. You certainly can't make it mandatory before it's fully accessible. So that question can't even be answered until June. But I do think you may see some companies do it. I mean, I can see an airline doing it or a hotel company doing it. I can see some people saying if the folks in our branches aren't vaccinated, they're not going in. So there will be pressure. And I would say carrots and sticks, not mandatory.
Another topic very of the now is SPACs. I'm interested why, when I look at the league table, does JP Morgan not seem to be doing especially well in the SPAC game?
Yeah, we were a day late and a dollar short. Probably a little skeptical going in.
Are you still skeptical?
I think you have to be cautious, okay? So I think if it's a good sponsor, if it's a fair sponsor deal, if it's got good pipe investors, if you really do due diligence in the acquisition, you know, these things can make sense. But clearly there's a lot of hype. There are a lot of sponsors that you shouldn't be doing business with, and so some of them will not end well. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do them, and it doesn't mean there aren't some good ones. But, you know, to us, we want to hold to J.P. Morgan standards the people we actually do business with.
Just turning to my home country for a moment, look, I know you've been hesitant in the past to opine on UK sovereign issues, but as a Brit, I can tell you there are scores of us, thousands of us, who would love to hear your opinion on London, particularly. What is the future for London as a financial centre now that we have gone through Brexit and this sort of much harder version of Brexit than many people expected?
Brexit, and I always got notes from Brits saying, go home, Yankee. keep your opinions to yourself. Look, I was not in favor of hard Brexit. We had a hard Brexit. is going to cause difficulties you've seen them. It's going to reduce their GDP, all things being equal. You know, look, I've always understood why you want to free yourself from, you know, what people considered a sclerotic Europe. But it may not play out that way. So they, you know, if I was a Brit, I'd be really careful about how you're going to compete in the new world. You have to deal with Europe. You're going to have to deal with all these other trading partners, et cetera. In terms of financial services, there was no deal done. So you really don't know. And now we're arguing equivalency or not. My view is what you can see is over time, parts that were done in London will be done elsewhere. So London will always be a financial center. It won't be the financial center of Europe. You're going to get other financial centers like Paris and Frankfurt, Dublin, maybe Amsterdam. And you've seen it already in certain products. That doesn't mean it won't extend to other products. Like, you know, if equity trading, why not FX trading? Why not bond trading? Why not? And I do think there'll be political and regulatory pressure over the next 10 years to move some of those things. So, and we want to leave it just the way it is. We love London. We love Britain. It's very efficient for us. And it's very efficient for our clients. It's much cheaper, et cetera, to leave it the way it is. But that's got to be settled between Europe and Britain. And so far, it doesn't look particularly good.
Much easier question for you. We're obviously sat here in New York, your home city. There's a lot going on in New York right now. There has been an exodus in the financial services industry. A lot of very smart people, big companies moving elsewhere. What keeps a business like JP Morgan in New York?
So, again, I think New York could have a little bit of a difficult time, too. Because, you know, already real estate needs will come down. Most of us are going to go to more open seating because you don't need 100 seats for 100 employees. You're going to need, like, 60. And then, of course, if you have higher individual taxes and higher corporate taxes, that does a pretty good job driving people out, as does crime, inhospitable business environment. So, you know, what the city needs to do is make itself what it has been for, just like London, a wonderful, absolute place to work and or visit. So that's the arts, it's the sciences, it's the parks, it's the safety, it's the soundness, it's the tax system, for London, it's the rule of law, it's all the things that surround the financial system there, it's the lawyers and the accountants and the tech people, and they're all kind of important. So we need to do that here. You're going to have some exits anyway, because, you know, some of the bad stuff has been happening too much, and you've seen a bunch of people already kind of vote with their feet and leave the city. So, but New York can fight back. It's just got to have a real strategy.
Yeah. Before we go, just a quick Jamie Dimon question. You know, you're going to be 65, I think, next week.
Yeah.
You've been in the job since 2005. Obviously, I think the only bank CEO of a major bank to have gone through the 08 crisis, still be navigating through the COVID crisis. It's not up to you. Obviously, you have a board and shareholders. But if it were, how much longer would you want to do this job for?
5 years.
That's the only answer. I know that was going to be
the
answer.
It's the only answer I've ever given. So, but it will be up to the board. We've got great people here. You know, they did a great job running this company while I was unable to. So, which I think proves we've got people in place who can do these things. And so,
how many people of your direct report group could actually step up and do the CEO job?
I think the ones I'm going to mention are, you know, Gordon Smith and Daniel Pinto. There are others, but those two, co-presidents, co-chief operating officers, they did it when I wasn't here. They've done an outstanding job, and obviously we have tons of, you know, exceptional people.
Yes, we got Tucker Carlson making comments about his address, our President Biden's address about, you know, all this COVID-19. He's trying to take credit for what Trump came up with. But one of these days, 6 months to a year from now, I think they'll be pointing fingers at each other and say, well, you did the COVID. You did the vaccine. I didn't do the vaccine. You brought it about. Because that vaccine is not a vaccine. It could have some real major health problems for the people that are taking it. So beware about these vaccines that are being, you know, talked about as being the panacea for everything. I think they can be very dangerous. So, you know, I can't advise that they're going to change things. But here we go now with Tucker Carlson.
Welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Tons going on, as always. So there were a lot of stories we could have opened with tonight, and we talked about it. But in the end, we couldn't get our minds off of Joe Biden's COVID speech. Did you see that last night? The one where he seemed so sad about the lockdowns that have crushed businesses and kept kids out of school, an entire generation, he said, and driven so many to suicide. Yet never once mentioned or even hinted that he and his party were the very forces behind those lockdowns. I'm really sorry about your black eye, he says as he punches you in the face. It was bizarre. The whole speech was like that. It had a hallucinogenic quality, like it wasn't quite real. But then Joe Biden himself isn't quite real. Maybe that's the reason he talks that way. Biden has been living in utter seclusion for more than a year. He hasn't spoken to anyone but his own lackeys. He hasn't driven a car or sat on the grass and looked up at the sky or been anywhere or done anything except in the most controlled possible environment. What an incredibly weird life that is. Joe Biden must imagine that everyone in America is as terrified of corona as he is and is living in the same kind of bunker. Joe Biden is totally cut off. Alex Berenson described last night's speech as late Soviet. The more we thought about it, the more perfect that seemed. Here's a clip of Russia's own Joe Biden, the late Leonid Brezhnev. Like Biden, Brezhnev was very clearly fading in his later years after a series of health problems. Also like Biden, despite his frailty and confusion, Brezhnev never lost his enthusiasm for pointless wars. He's the one who ordered the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. In late December of that year, Brezhnev addressed the Soviet youth in a televised speech. As you watch this, see if you can spot the similarities to what you saw last night. And keep in mind, when this was shot, Brezhnev was a full 5 years younger than Joe Biden is today.
Вот это мама лучше.
Да, посмотрим. Вы попробуйте, как.
Вот так лучше. Я взял другие очки. Запнутые.
Вы смотрите на текст, конечно.
Только всего.
Now they're trying to tell him how the teleprompter works. He harumphs a bit and looks vacant. He doesn't quite get it. Brezhnev didn't actually lead Russia by this point, and you can see why. He remained the country's figurehead, but it was the ideologues behind the scenes who ran the show. Brezhnev had his own Susan Rice and Barack Obama to make the real decisions. The similarities, as we said, are pretty amazing. Over at CNN, however, they didn't see it. Or maybe they did see it and they didn't care. CNN always did love Brezhnev. In any case, the usual chorus of toadies strained for a high note last night. Watch them tell you how wonderful the speech was, as if you didn't have a TV and didn't see it for yourself.
How refreshing. How human. How compassionate. How American.
Biden tried to lift our spirits with a medicinal message about recovering our sense of collective cause. Certainly it was healing.
He didn't say, you need me. He said, I need you. I need you. I mean, my God, that is, isn't that it?
People always talk about the feeling of the relief they have hearing Biden. But what he's doing now soars above that.
What the president is saying is help is on the way.
We're all in this together. I need your help. We're all Americans.
Woo! Hallelujah.
Hallelujah, says Don Lamont. Can I get an amen? Clear the aisles. It's time for an altar call. Brother Biden is preaching the word. Preach, Brother Biden. Preach. Speak. What are these people talking about? What was it about Joe Biden's shaky monotone last night that inspired them exactly? Most people found it depressing. Maybe we're being too literal here. Probably doesn't matter what Joe Biden actually said. He could have called for the bombing of Toronto and CNN's panel of trained steels would still enthusiastically applaud it. It's their job to enthusiastically applaud what Joe Biden says. Our job is to try and figure out what Biden's speech meant for the country. So let's look at it for a minute. The lockdowns have been tough, Biden conceded at the outset. God knows how we got them. But we did. Those restrictions will be lifted as soon as we can lift them, and we will return to some version of the country we now only dimly remember. We'd really love to do that. We mean it. We'd love it. But in order to go forward and take the boot off your neck, we're going to need every American to listen very carefully and to obey our orders. Do what we tell you to do. Now, that won't be easy. But if you do it, there is a payoff for good behavior. If you're obedient, there's a chance, not a guarantee, of course, but a distinct possibility, God willing, that you may be able to see some of the people you love around July 4th. That could actually happen, ladies and gentlemen. Listen to this.
If we do our part, if we do this together, by July the 4th, there's a good chance you, your families and friends will be able to get together in your backyard or in your neighborhood and have a cookout and a barbecue and celebrate Independence Day. That doesn't mean large events with lots of people together, but it does mean small groups will be able to get together.
Did you hear that, America? There is a good chance, again, not a sure thing, but what is a sure thing these days? But a good chance that you might be allowed to have a modest cookout 4 months from now. That is, as long as you obey regulations, weather permitting, and assuming that current federal projections unfold according to plan. That's your prize! This offer, by the way, does not apply to full-time employees, the radio station, or their families. But with luck, this could be your reward after a year and a half of lockdowns. A 4th of July cookout in your very own backyard, assuming you have one. Don't ever tell us that Joe Biden isn't a compassionate, generous man. Here he is offering you, with some medically necessary caveats outlined by Dr. Anthony Fauci, the right to cook your own hot dogs. With the provision, obviously, that you do it in a small, masked group seated far apart at a prescribed distance from one another. Don't get crazy and hug or celebrate or talk too loud or anything like that. Moderation is the key here. But still, a socially distanced barbecue. What other wonders does President Biden have in store for us? Well, you're going to have to get vaccinated to find out. Sorry, that's the other requirement. Should have mentioned it. Everybody needs the shot, period. That's what Biden said. And that's a lot of shots. The good news, now that we're on what Joe Biden describes as a, quote, war footing with this virus, vaccinating people against it is a counterterrorism operation. What we did to ISIS, we're going to do to COVID. Biden didn't mention drones, but we will need soldiers. And that's why Joe Biden is building a vaccination corps that will include active duty members of the military, an army of vaccinators. Watch.
2 months ago, the country, this country, didn't have nearly enough vaccine supply to vaccinate all or ever near all of the American public. But soon we will. Now, because all the work we've done, we'll have enough vaccine supply for all adults in America by the end of May. That's months ahead of schedule. And we're mobilizing thousands of vaccinators to put the vaccine in one's arm.
Thousands of vaccinators to vaccinate everyone. That sounds amazing. But it does raise at least one vexing question. What if you don't want to get vaccinated? Not everyone does. Some people have religious objections. Others have concerns about this specific medicine. Others simply don't want it. Do you need a reason to turn down the vaccine? And what happens if you do turn it down? Will you be allowed to fly on airplanes or go to work or enter the front doors of Madison Square Garden? Joe Biden didn't specify, but it's pretty hard to believe he would support any kind of vaccine coercion. As he has told us so often over so many years, if it's your body, it's your choice.
I support a woman's right to choose under that constitutional guaranteed provision. And quite frankly, I always will. Folks, you know, and I'm going to fight to protect a woman's right to make her own personal decisions when it gets to her health care.
Quite frankly, you've got the absolute right to make your own personal decisions about your own personal health care. Period. That's in the Constitution. Joe Biden would never violate that right. He's been defending that right since before you were born. It's your body. It's your choice. Period. Of course, as with everything, there are caveats. If you don't take the shot that Joe Biden wants you to take, if you persist in making your own personal decisions about your own personal health care, then Joe Biden is going to have to shut the country down again. No socially distanced barbecues for you, buddy. You're going to have to eat your hot dogs alone inside.
If we don't stay vigilant and the conditions change, then we may have to reinstate restrictions to get back on track.
To which CNN might say, hallelujah! But we're not seeing it. Instead, we're left wondering, could there be any civil liberties implications to any of this? We don't know the answer, and that's why we are happy to turn to attorney and journalist Glenn Greenwald, who joins us tonight. Glenn, thanks so much for coming on. Now, I don't think this is necessarily a debate about vaccines or this vaccine or medicine even. There is a civil liberties component to all of this that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. How do you see it?
There's been a civil liberties component to the COVID debate from the very beginning. Obviously, there have been extreme debates about free speech. Now yes. You're not permitted to question the efficacy of masks, whereas a year ago, if you had gone online and said that you should wear masks, you probably would have been banned because the consensus of the time was that you shouldn't. But there was a very consistent message for the first 4 to 5 months, which was anyone who doesn't stay at home is essentially killing grandma sociopathically, risking the lives of our older citizens. And then suddenly in May, when George Floyd was killed by the Minneapolis police and there was this huge protest movement all over America, suddenly the exact opposite message rained down, which was now it's not only your obligation not to stay at home anymore, it's your obligation to go out onto the street. Huge numbers of people densely packed, one on top of the other. From the very beginning, health advice and lockdown laws and just the social ethos surrounding what we're required to do has been completely politicized by people pretending to only follow the science. And we've seen some of the most draconian limitations on our freedom of movement, on our freedom of association, on our ability to live. Businesses closed all over the United States and no right even to question the efficacy or the wisdom of those policies.
So on the question of vaccines, and again, this is not a debate about this vaccine or whether you should get vaccinated, but there are some people who don't want the vaccine for whatever reason. It seems very likely at this point that they will be restricted from doing a number of things that Americans have taken for granted that they can do, like go to work on or fly on airplanes. Is there a civil liberties implication there? Is that a violation of their rights?
Of course. I personally intend to take the vaccine when it becomes right. available. That's just the assessment personally that I have made. But other people, as you've said, for scientific reasons, for political reasons, for religious reasons, or whatever other reasons, don't want to take the vaccine. In fact, large numbers of the population, not just in the United States, but in countries around the world, are adamant about not taking it. The question then becomes, why should they be restricted? If all of us who want to take the vaccine and who are able to take it are now protected from getting the virus or from having the virus harm the organism when we do get it, that's the point of the vaccine, why are people who don't take the vaccine a threat to anyone but themselves, which is essentially the whole foundation of individual liberty, is that you always have the right to do whatever you want without the government requiring you, as long as you're not hurting anybody else. But they're already talking about things like vaccine passports, where you only can have the rights of citizenry if you submit to a vaccine that you don't actually want to have. And I can't even think of, maybe since the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, a civil liberties restriction as draconian and disturbing as that.
I think I haven't heard it as crisply and intelligently summarized as that. And there's no question as to why they're trying to shut you up, which they definitely are. And I hope they never succeed. Glenn Greenwald, thank you.
Thanks, Tucker.
Well, it was quite an experience yesterday being the very first target in the Pentagon's new Operation Silence the Talk Show Hosts. Friends called us in concern. Are you guys all right? And for a minute, we'll concede we were almost rattled. Then we realized if the woke generals treat us like they've treated the Taliban, we'll be fine. 20 years later, the Taliban are still here. Maybe we ought to promise the Pentagon that we'll get rid of traditional gender roles on this show, change the pronouns, defeat the patriarchy, and all that. Then they'd send us billions in unmarked $100 bills as a reward. They've certainly done that before. And that might really kickstart our struggling opium poppy business. Something to think about. Anyway, we're fine. So thank you for the concern.
Here's a quick clip from Glenn Beck with Harry Dent coming up right now. Listen to this. It's important.
In what, 2019, you said in the spring something will happen and the stock market will fall and the economy will totally change. It was COVID that was that something that happened. And you've been right. Now, what does this mean, this GameStop thing? Some people say it's the beginning of the end and it's a real revolution. Some people say it was no big deal. Some people say that it is going to change and the oligarchs are going to rule because of this.
But, you know, I see it more on the revolution side because we're in a very important cycle like the American Revolution that brought in democracy and knocked down the monarchs for the first time. Before that, it was the Protestant Revolution that took down the all-powerful Catholic Church of the time. I think it's the central banks going down this time, and I cannot wait. Because this whole GameStop thing only happens in an environment I call the markets on crack. So people think the insiders are manipulating the market. A poll just showed 66% of people, insiders are manipulating the market. Well, it's worse than that. It starts with the Federal Reserve and central banks. They've been pumping money nonstop. Now, you got to realize, this is not lowering interest rates and inducing people to borrow a little more. This is literally putting trillions of dollars direct, created out of nowhere, into the markets, which means now more money chasing the same financial assets that pushes them up. But that's not all, because they say we're going to constantly buy these bonds, which pushes down long-term and short-term rates. That means bonds go up. Oh, and that means stocks go up. So the traders, the big traders, the real manipulators, see, oh my gosh, now we can leverage even more. And oh, because we know the direction Fed's going to push stuff and we're not going to see downturns for long, it reduces the risk. Oh, and now it costs almost nothing with fake interest rates, zero rates, to finance this leverage. So what has been happening? I've been saying this for years, and you have too, good. The big money, the hedge funds and the leverage traders, they throw their weight around. They have the best information. They know what everybody is doing. You, me, little traders, other funds, everything. And when they see people going in one direction, like bullish, they jump on it and they short. And the problem is, I don't mind that they short. Anybody should be able to go long or short. The problem is they can do it on high leverage with options and futures and literally just push a market down until the people that are long capitulate. So they've been doing this for a long time.
So,
and I tell traders, it's hard to do.
Harry, what's really disturbing to me is, I mean, first of all, you're exactly right. The Fed has been they call it investing. They have been dumping money into the stock market, which creates a bogus stock market. They are putting money in, not little people. And what happens is when the Fed just starts to buy the stock market, the Fed has gone to advisors. Their advisors on who to invest in has been BlackRock. Well, now BlackRock, all of the heads of BlackRock, I think except for one, are now in the Biden administration. The chief economic advisor for the president, Biden, is now BlackRock executive. The chief economic advisor for Kamala Harris is now a BlackRock executive. The right-hand man for Yellen in the Treasury Department is a BlackRock guy. Even Goldman Sachs didn't have this.
The former Fed chairman, which puts a Fed chairman and a Fed person in the Treasury. So, yeah, we got everything locked towards endless stimulus, and this just invites leverage. So, again, Fed adds money to the markets, pushing up prices. Traders add a lot more leverage, pushing up prices anymore. You know what the most important number in the economy right now, Glenn? Nobody's talking about it. $520 trillion in financial assets globally, 6.2 times global GDP at 84 million, and way more than money and everything else. This is the biggest bubble. It's worse than the debt bubble at 253 trillion. See, in a normal economy, a growth economy, debt might be 1.5 times GDP, and financial assets might be 2.5. Now there's 6.2, debt's over 3 times. This is the greatest bubble, but the bubble now, because the central banks use quantitative easing, putting the money in, as you're saying, this is what's created the financial asset bubble. This is a bigger monster than the debt bubble, and that can deleverage and disappear money even faster than the debt deleveraging. So these guys are creating a monster that's going to kick them very hard, and I think it's coming literally in weeks or months.